The right to a trial by jury is an essential feature of the American justice system, not to mention primetime television. But how much do you really know about how juries are formed and how they work? On today's edition of Please Explain, we're going to talk about trial juries, grand juries, runaway juries, and juries of all kinds. And of course, we'll be taking your calls later. With me now are Paula Hannaford-Agor, the director of the Center for Jury Studies at the National Center for State Courts, and Valerie Hans, a professor at Cornell University Law School. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Leonard. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Paula, where did the idea of a trial by jury originate? Do we know?
Well, it actually goes back fairly far in history. There is some discussion of something that looked a little bit like trial by jury going back as far as ancient Greece and ancient Rome. Probably for the American jury comes from Great Britain. That's been an institution in the British justice system really going back to the Battle of Hastings, but certainly in its present form, roughly about probably the 15th to 16th century.
Well, the British tradition also includes the Magna Carta, which guaranteed a right to be heard by a jury, didn't it?
Exactly, and that was the Magna Carta that came after the Battle of Hastings.
And at that time, I assume the juries were quite different?
They were. At that time, the juries really weren't deciding guilt or innocence in the same way or just listening to the evidence. They really acted more like the king's local witnesses to investigate the crime and make a report to the king of exactly what had happened and whether or not a defendant was guilty or not guilty of a charge.
Valerie, where did the idea of a jury of 12 individuals come from? Do we know?
Well, there's a lot of dispute about that. Some people refer to the apostles as divine inspiration for the number 12, but others, including our Supreme Court, tend to think it was more of a historical accident. And so, in fact, the Supreme Court's taken the view that when we think about features of the jury, like how many people should be on it and whether or not they should have to agree unanimously on a verdict, that what we should do is look at how these features affect the functioning of the jury. And it turns out the number 12 is a much better representation of the population than some of the a lower number like 6. Many people have tried to, and in fact some states do use smaller juries, but 12 does remain a better representation of the community.
And the diversity of the community.
Absolutely.
Are there some? So you say there are some places where juries are down to 6, but I'd imagine that those are not for serious cases, are they?
That's right. In Florida, though, there's a whole range of cases that are heard by small juries. Isn't that right, Paula?
That's correct. They do both felony and misdemeanor trials as well as all civil trials. I think only capital felony, death penalty trials, are tried to a jury of 12 in Florida.
Well, since Florida was the source of so much judicial dispute, I'm wondering whether we could have a precedent decided on the basis of a jury of 6. We're talking about juries and the jury system on today's Please Explain with Valerie Hans and Paula Hansford-Agor. Paula, what would be the most basic definition of the word jury?
Oh, there's an interesting question. Typically, the definition that I use when I'm speaking to different groups is that it is a group of people whose role it is to decide the facts of a case and apply the governing law to that case to come up with a verdict.
Trying to be impartial?
Impartial, representative of the community is another characteristic that's usually associated.
And sometimes the fact that it's a jury of one's peers becomes a problem because it's not always so easy to get people who we can consider the peers of a person who's being tried.
Well, interestingly, that phrase, a jury of one's peers, did not originally intend to mean people who look like me. As originally, a peer was a person who lived in the community where a crime was committed.
Mm-hmm.
So a jury of one's peers was actually the demographic characteristics of the community, not the demographics of the individual people being tried.
And now sometimes we actually move a trial away from the place where the crime was committed to get away from the peers because they might have biases.
Exactly. Certainly if there's been a lot of pretrial publicity in a case where, or it's a very close-knit community and lots of people have been affected by the crime or by the case, then it might be very difficult to find a group of 12 people who don't have very firmly held opinions about the case and about what the outcome should be.
Valerie, are there...
McVeigh actually is a good example of that. He was the man who was responsible for the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma, and that trial was moved out of the state after the judge concluded that they couldn't get a fair trial in the state of Oklahoma.
So we have to balance the right to have a trial by one's peers with the right to have a fair trial at all.
Exactly.
Are there times when you can't ask for a trial by jury?
Well, some at least criminal charges don't allow for a trial by jury. They tend to be smaller offenses, misdemeanors, so that's one of the limitations on trial by jury.
And then there's juvenile cases, I understand.
Juvenile and some family law cases, divorce, child support, those types of cases. Increasingly, we've seen over the last century or so sort of an eradication of the right to trial by jury at some of these lower levels. It used to be very common, for example, to have municipal ordinance violations tried by jury. And
right.
Quite frequently, those, you know, simply that right to have it decided whether or not you put your fence in the wrong place on your property is no longer something that you can demand a jury trial for.
Now, I've never served on a grand jury, but friends tell me I should try to avoid it like the plague because it'll eat up a large part of my life. What about grand juries?
Well, the grand jury is different from a trial jury. This is actually a group, and typically a larger group, typically 23 or 24, hence the name. The grand jury actually comes from the French grand, meaning large. The trial jury is also sometimes called the petit jury or the small jury. But the grand jury is really impaneled to decide whether or not there's probable cause to think a crime has been committed. And so their role is actually to look at the evidence that the police bring and say, yeah, we think a crime has been committed and therefore you may arrest and charge this person with this crime. Then it goes into the court system and the petit jury is actually the one to decide whether in fact the defendant actually committed that crime.
Well, it's been...
If I could just interrupt here. I mean, there's an interesting way where they do different things, but each has the grand jury and the petit jury, but each has this important role of representing the community's judgment. So in the grand jury, community members are able to decide whether or not to proceed with the case. And in the petit jury, they're able to decide whether or not to find someone guilty or not guilty.
It's been said that no district attorney worth his salt cannot get an indictment from a grand jury.
Yes, that's a damning phrase applied to the grand jury.
So
we
is that
don't know all that much about grand juries. I think in part because of the secrecy that surrounds their operations. In contrast, we've done lots of research, and a whole field of jury studies has grown up studying the operation of the petit jury or trial jury.
And there are people who think that grand juries are just should be eliminated. In this country, we use more juries than any other country, don't we?
That's correct. We have in the U.S. annually, our best estimate is there's about 170,000 jury trials conducted each year.
It's a system that isn't perfect, but we seem to have a deep belief in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the jury is actually one of those institutions in the country that's very positively regarded. At the same time as everybody tries to get out of jury duty, they love the institution.
Now, different states have different ways of selecting juries. In New York State, they seem to just have compiled millions of different lists. So if you can't escape one way, they get you another way.
Well, it's not so much of trying to avoid the escape, although one of the things that courts have been trying very hard to do is to, if anything, equalize the burden of jury service. There's no question that jury service is a burdensome activity. It's a rather weighty responsibility. But one thing that courts have been trying to do over time is to reduce the amount of time that people have to serve, and also distribute that burden of jury service more equitably, so you don't have large classes of people who aren't eligible or aren't available for jury service by virtue of the fact that, you know, they don't vote or they don't drive, they're not on one of these lists, or they're not statutorily exempt for some reason.
Well, if someone has never been called and wants to know why, what do they do? Is there a way of determining why your name has never been called?
Well, if you're not certainly on one of the statutory lists, and as you mentioned, in New York State, which has a pretty comprehensive list of eligible citizens, it's hard to imagine someone who doesn't drive, doesn't vote, doesn't pay taxes, has never received unemployment compensation, and I forget what the fifth list is, but it's a pretty comprehensive group there. But it is done exclusively by random selection, and based on the county. So if you've got a county that has a very low number of jury trials each year and simply isn't summoning a lot, as well as just that random selection, some people will be summoned will be selected every year, and some people will never be selected.
And then after you're selected, then you can be selected to be impaneled on a jury, and they put you through a series of questions called the voir dire. I've read that in other countries, England, for example, the voir dire consists of one question. They simply ask the potential jurors whether they feel they can give equal weight to both sides and come to a fair judgment.
Yeah, that's right.
How did it come to be such a complicated thing here?
Yeah, the U.S. has a much more elaborated jury selection system than any of the other places that use juries. There is a presumption that seems to be built into the trial procedures in other countries that bias is a rarity, and there are some procedures in place that can be used, but they're not the default as they are here in the United States.
But with this kind of maneuvering might lend itself to different kinds of impartiality. One lawyer might be cleverer at getting jurors eliminated through the voir dire.
Yeah, well, there have been a few studies that have tried to look at how successful attorneys are in their voir dire challenges, and one of the kind of intriguing, I don't know, it's sort of reassuring and sort of sad, is that they're not that great, and it's probably no deep inadequacy on the lawyer's part, but just it's very difficult to predict complicated human behavior, like how somebody is going to look at evidence in a case, deliberate with others, and render a decision in that case. So the complexity of it probably is a bit of reassurance for the rest of us that you really can't stack a jury, even though many people would like to.
Can we talk a bit about what happens when the jurors are actually deciding a case, what they call the story model?
Yeah, the kind of tradition in our system is, in the adversary system, is that jurors are supposed to be passive. Each attorney presents evidence and arguments in the case. The judge presides over the trial, but jurors themselves aren't actively involved in seeking out evidence. And the whole notion here, the assumption is that passivity will lead to them being impartial until the entire case has been presented and they can reach a decision. What we've learned from some of the jury studies is that even though they're sitting there in the jury box quietly often, they're actually actively formulating narrative accounts of the evidence as they hear bits and pieces of it presented by different witnesses. They're trying to figure out what the story is of the case. What are the motives of the various parties? How plausible are the claims that people are making as they testify and as they attempt to put this together into a coherent narrative? They are aided in part by the law. And at the end of the case, they take their narrative, their story, the account that they have developed on the basis of the evidence, and look at the legal options, look for the closest fit. And that's our current understanding of what jurors do and how they arrive at a verdict, is a matching process by which they take the story and match it to the closest alternative in the range of verdicts they have before them.
I understand that the jury for the trial of Louis Libby has requested a flip chart, masking tape, post-it notes, and a document with photos of the witnesses. I guess they're trying to put together a story modeled that way.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the deliberative process, is having each of the jurors then compare their own story or narrative that they've developed against the stories of the other jurors to see, you know, how much do these stories agree with one another or disagree with one another? Mm-hmm. Are there different interpretations, different inferences to be taken from this evidence?
Yeah, exactly. And this is probably what makes the jury a pretty strong and sound decision maker, is this opportunity not only to individually develop an account of the case, but to test it in the heat of the deliberation room, as Paula is saying.
My guests are Valerie Hans, professor at Cornell University Law School, and Paula Hannaford-Agor, the director of the Center for Jury Studies at the National Center for State Courts. We will continue this edition of Please Explain right after this.
Despite all the attempts of science through lie detectors and other instruments to get at the truth, most of us feel, as our district attorney has stated previously, that the jury is the best lie detector of them all.
That was May LaGuardia broadcasting a speech here on WNYC in 1938. He was speaking about the importance of the jury system, and we want to thank WNYC archivist Andy Lancet for finding that for us. But is that true? We keep on hearing about people who've been sent to jail by juries that have made mistakes. I don't know if it's always the jury that's at fault, or the people who present the evidence, or the judges, but this is a rather imperfect system, isn't it, Paula?
Well, it depends on what your measurement of perfect and imperfect is. One of the things that, you know, we certainly do hear stories about people who have been exonerated, who have been convicted by juries. But one of the things that I certainly take great comfort from is thinking about how often the legal professionals end up agreeing with what the jury's verdict is. When there have been studies, and these studies going back for now more than half a century, that compare what the judge said that he or she would have ruled in a case versus what the jury actually decided, we find that the agreement rate tends to stay pretty stable between 75% and 80%.
But I gather that studies indicate juries are more likely to consider reasonable doubt, and that a judge is more likely to bring his entire life experience into his thinking about a case. So he might be less lenient. Jurors are always, since they're doing it for the first time, they're less likely to feel certain of their own judgment and knowledge.
Well, there's in terms of that disagreement rate, that 20 or 25% of cases, I mean, there is a question of, you know, certainly who has the better judgment. If a judge, you know, do judges over the course of their career, you know, essentially become jaded? I've seen this before, I've heard this defense before, I've seen this particular witness before, and therefore make their decision that way. I actually think that disagreement rate is one of the things that tells me that the jury is actually working the way it should. If the judges and juries agreed 100% of the time, in fact, why would you actually need a jury? It would seem to be superfluous and rather a lot of money and effort to go to come up with the same result. But the fact that you have people in the community who can disagree with legal experts about what inferences to make, what conclusions to draw from the evidence, strikes me as precisely why we have a jury system.
Valerie, what about unanimity? Except in certain rare instances, aren't juries expected to come to a unanimous decision?
Yes, they are, at least in criminal trials. Most of the states, not everyone, there are a couple of exceptions, but most of the states require everybody to agree unanimously. And the work that I've done and other people have done seems to suggest that that's actually a very powerful feature of juries that encourages its very strong fact-finding. If you know you can outvote people and get on with your life and not have to reach unanimity, it tends to result in less thorough discussion of the evidence. And if somebody's in the minority, you can simply outvote them and proceed, deliver your verdict, and go home for the day.
And that's what made 12 Angry Men so effective.
I love that movie. I love that movie, but it did obviously show you that in some instances people can really persuade. Now, I've often used 12 Angry Men to say, real juries aren't like that. Real juries, it's extremely rare when there's one individual who can sway the entire rest of the jury. Typically, majorities do rule. In some of our research done as part of the National Center for State Courts research agenda on juries, shows that there are a handful of cases, 5 to 10% of the cases, where minorities do manage to convince the rest of the people that they've got the right view of the case.
But isn't it very likely, or don't people suspect anyway, that strong talkers or people with status jobs are more likely to sway juries than people who just have a gut feeling on their side?
Well, what status in the jury room is kind of like status on the outside. So if you've got a high status occupation, if you are a manager, if you're used to being in groups and being a leader in groups, if you're a male, that also helps. And if you have a lot of education, all those kinds of things that give you status in the outside world would make you more influential, typically, on the inside of the jury room as well.
But those people are not kept off of juries.
No, but again, this is what makes the unanimity requirement attractive, at least partly. Even if you don't have those status characteristics, the jury has to pay attention to you. So there's an equalizing quality that comes from the requirement in criminal cases, anyway, that juries be unanimous.
And I think there's another piece of that in terms of the status. To a certain extent, you really wouldn't want the jury to, simply reduce to the lowest common denominator. And one of the benefits of having a diverse jury that includes different socioeconomic status, different viewpoints, different life experiences, is that it allows people to really draw upon their strengths and combine their strengths and their knowledge as they're coming to a verdict. And what we've seen in terms of studies of jury deliberations is that they do actually use the strengths and the knowledge of different people to help interpret the evidence.
Well, a caller says that he was at a voir dire last week, and he found that the lawyers seemed to prefer prospective jurors who were more quiet and passive when they responded to questions.
Probably relying on the stereotype that those quiet, passive people would be more open to their arguments.
My guests are Paula Hannaford-Agor, the director of the Center for Jury Studies at the National Center for State Courts, and Valerie Hans, a professor at Cornell University Law School, whose book on the jury system will be published by Prometheus Press later this year. It's called American Jury, The Verdict. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. And Zaida, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I was just wanting to express that I served on a grand jury in Brooklyn several months ago, and I was absolutely disgusted. I think, just to tell you my perspective, I'm also a non-practicing attorney. And so I think I had, you know, certain legal concepts down that other people didn't have. But in general, it was just a sham, and it was a joke. People didn't take it seriously. People wanted to go home. One of your guests talked about all the different numbers of places where they could pull jurors from. On a jury in Brooklyn with 23 people, there was not one black man on my jury. And almost all of the people that came before us were black. And so, in general, the whole thing was just, upsetting to me. Just from the directions we were given from the beginning, we're sort of downplayed our role.
Well, let me ask my guests. Do you think that it's different when people serve on a grand jury than when they serve on a petit jury? Because my experience has been that people take it very seriously when they are deliberating on a case that may involve a jail sentence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the studies that we've done and other people have done of jurors in the small jurors, the trial jurors, not grand jurors, mm-hmm. like our guest is talking about, usually show a lot of satisfaction, even if the verdict doesn't go the way you want it to go, a fair amount of satisfaction and a belief that you were deeply engaged and were doing something important. And what's disturbing about your example is that none of those things seem to have occurred. And, you know, I wonder, too, about the representativeness of grand juries and what's going on with the process of selecting grand juries in Brooklyn.
We thank you for your call. Fred from New Milford, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I served on a jury, a murder case in New Jersey, and also on a grand jury. And really, I'll go back to the first case. The scenario was, it was sad because the public defender basically fell asleep. It was basically a sad case. The defense was unfortunate. And we came to the jury, unanimously came to the decision that it was premeditated murder. It was an interesting case, but it was really a case that could have used a better defense. But with the instructions that we received, there was nothing else that we could do, and we all felt, the whole jury felt, it was just a very sad situation based on a representation. On the grand jury side, I've heard the statement and heard that many times that you can indict a ham sandwich, mm-hmm. and that's what it comes down to. And I was one of the dissenting people when it came down to certain cases that were presented to us for indictment. And I felt that there weren't enough questions. The grand jury wasn't questioning the prosecutor, pressing the assistant DA that presented the case. And it's just that the whole system sometimes, I'm not saying it doesn't work in general, but sometimes it's just frustrating.
Go ahead. Valerie?
Well, I think one of the things that Fred said really hits home, and that's the concern the jury had with the public defender and the vigor of the defense. And, you know, in a way, the jury is sometimes blamed for things that it really doesn't have a lot of control over. Some of the mistaken convictions, for example, are honest and credible eyewitnesses who nevertheless testify to an identification that later turns out to be false. So there are flaws in the evidence. There are sometimes flaws in the forensics that are put before the jury in a very authoritative way by experts. But this also is
a murder case with a public defender.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we hope to have somebody who would be I'm not saying that there aren't great public defenders out there. But you do want to have somebody who would not fall asleep and who might very well be more adept at handling a case like that, be able to do a little more research. Well, we thank you for your call, Fred. And Joe from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I've been on several juries and been very frustrated, felt like I had my hands tied, for two main reasons. One, jurors aren't allowed to take notes during the trial. I'm getting on in years, and my memory isn't that good, and help me to make some notes. And the other, jurors aren't allowed to ask questions. Once in a trial, I raised my hand, and the judge and the defense attorney and everybody else looked over me in shock.
We have about 50 seconds.
Okay.
Can we get a response?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm glad that Joe raised that because his frustration is something that I think a lot of the courts are hearing, and there's been very broad-based reforms going on around the country to try and address some of those. The National Center just recently did a study of state courts and found that now about 70% of judges permit jurors to take notes during trial. And about 15% are now allowing jurors to submit questions to witnesses.
But not in New York State.
Not in New York State, but it's even coming there. There's been pilot studies going on in New York State to address that.
We have to leave it there. My great thanks to both of you, Valerie Hands and Paula Hannaford Agor. And it's been a fascinating Please Explain on Juries. On Monday, we'll start off this show with a panel of remarkable women explorers. And then we talk to a man who went in the ring with Olympic boxers, jiu-jitsu stars, and Thai kickboxers to find out why we fight and why people like to watch. Plus a revival of a little-known play by Jam Barry, the author of Peter Pan. And Mia Farrow tells us about her recent trips to Chad and the Central African Republic. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or want to find out more about a guest or segment, you can find archives and information at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, Lorianne Kruszewski, Tess Hartman, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.